This interview is with Kay Cann, 917 North Broadway, Fargo, North Dakota. Kay is an artist, a writer, a politician, a lover of the arts, including theater and music. This interview is taking place at the home of Kay and her husband, Stan Cann, on February 29, 1988. The interviewer is Janet D. Gallagher, Audubon, Minnesota, representing the Communications Committee of the Oral History Project, sponsored by the Heritage Education Commission. Kay, when you and Stan were married for 50 years in 1986, you both wrote a missal called the Cann Gazette. I couldn't put it down once I started reading it. Could we start back then? Because I believe your art career started soon after you were married.
That's right, it did. However, even before that, I guess I got my interest in the theater from my father. He was a railroad man, and every year on his vacation, we rode the train from International Falls to Minneapolis and stayed in a hotel for a week. In the daytime, we rode streetcars all over Minneapolis, to Minnehaha Park, Excelsior Park, Longfellow Gardens, and many other places. And every night, we went to a vaudeville show at the Orpheum, the Pantages, the State, and other theaters that I can't even remember these days. I feel as though I grew up in the Orpheum Theater, and I saw so many wonderful performers there, from Olson and Johnson doing their wonderful Who's on First routine, to Al Jolson and the Marx Brothers. Both of my parents were avid readers, and I grew up reading two or three papers a day, and I still start my day with the Minneapolis Tribune and the Fargo Forum. I never was exposed to art until we moved to Stillwater, and I have no background in music. When we were first married, we lived in Stillwater when Stan became editor of the Stillwater Gazette in 1936, and that's the year we were married. He got passes to almost every theater and sports event in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we attended every theatrical event in both cities and saw some wonderful actors, from Louise Rainer in The Good Earth — that's the first play I ever remember seeing, and it was at the old Lyceum Theater — to Katharine Hepburn twice, once years ago in As You Like It, and a few years ago in a play in which she performed in a wheelchair. Oh, we saw John Gielgud, Lunton Fontaine, Henry Fonda, and so many others. We've continued going to the theater and many, many plays in the cities every year. Often we go down and see three or four plays or performances in 2 days at the Guthrie, the Chanhassen, the Ordway, Orchestra Hall, and the Mixed Blood and Penumbra theaters. I also developed an interest in art in Stillwater, where a good friend was Jo Lutz Rollins. She was a very well-known artist in those days, who taught at the art department at the University of Minnesota, and she had a summer art colony in Stillwater. I attended the art colony, and she introduced me to artists and art galleries in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Almost every week I went to the cities, and almost always included the Minneapolis Art Institute or the Walker in my day there. Later, I joined the art class of a wonderful art teacher named Arthur Carrick, a very well-known Twin Cities artist in those days. 25 of his students rented the old Cass Gilbert Depot in Stillwater, and we spent a whole day there with Carrick every week. And on Saturdays, we held art classes for children to help pay the rent. When we moved to Valley City in 1950, I guess it was, I started to paint there with several friends. We painted in Helen Foss's basement. That's Mrs. L. Foss of the Foss Drug in Moorhead Valley City. One of the other painters was Mary Gray. She's now one of the best-known painters and weavers in North Dakota. At that time, the only art show in North Dakota was in Bismarck every fall. We all would take the train from Valley City to Bismarck for that show. And one fall, we decided to have our own show. We rented the country club in Valley City one Saturday in September, and had a tea for ladies in the afternoon and a cocktail party for couples at night. One person we invited was Paul Hendrickson, who had just arrived from Boston to be the head of the Valley City Art Department. And he didn't think very much of our art, but he was very impressed that we could get 350 people to look at it with cookies and cocktails. The next week he was on the phone getting us to help him organize a statewide art show, which he envisioned as in a huge tent like those they held on the Boston Commons. So the next spring in 1959, the first Valley City Art Festival was held, with Helen Foss and I as chairman, but not in a tent in the armory. It was a huge success, and we counted about 5,000 people who came over, I think it was 4 days that we had the show. Among them were some members of the Fargo Junior League, and they came home and started the Red River Annual in Fargo. It was held here for years, but unfortunately folded 2 or 3 years ago. It was a juried show, excuse me, and I had paintings accepted in it several years. The Valley City Art Festival is still held, and the Valley City Art Association runs the Second Crossing Gallery at Valley City State College. The 15th biennial will be held in 1989. We also started the Barnes County Children's Show in 1960, and it has continued ever since.
You know, Kay, the thing that amazes me about you, you never quite wanted to quit learning. You went to college wherever you could, and you did that at Valley City, didn't you?
Yeah, I started back to college in Valley City.
And probably at that time you started your work as a society editor of the Times Record?
Yes. One day Stan called up and asked me to come down and answer the phone for a couple of days, and I stayed there 2 years as a society editor, and that was my first experience as a journalist.
And did your husband help you along that way, or was
not
that
really?
No,
I just kind of fell into it. It was fun. I enjoyed doing it.
You got a degree there, though, didn't you?
No, I started to school. That year, let's see, Stan moved to Valley City or to Fargo as what did he do? He started the morning edition of the Fargo Forum. And our youngest son was graduating from high school that year, so we stayed so he could graduate in Valley City.
You did that on several times. You did that
yes.
several times. You stayed back.
Yes,
you stayed behind. You must have had a few tough things going for you when you were reading.
Yeah, during the war, too. Yes. I stayed with Stan's family in Faribault while he was in the Army, and we had two small children at that time.
But so you made up for all those hard days and started in on your art, and you became a writer and a full-time student at Valley City.
When we moved to Fargo, I started at NDSU, and my youngest son went to school with me, so we were both in college for 2 or 3 years at Fargo.
How did Jim feel about you going to school? Was that an enjoyable thing, or was
he
a little...
liked it. We enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. That's fun. Let's see.
Now, you went to work for the Fargo Forum as a columnist when you moved to Fargo, and you continued your art, and you just kept getting deeper and deeper into art, I believe, when you moved into Fargo.
Well, I wanted to tell you about going to college, I guess. I started in Valley City, and actually that was purely by accident. I went up there to take an art class just to pass the time away while Stan was gone that year. And I ran into Dr. Locken in the hall, who was the president of the college at that time, Ross Locken. He said, "What are you doing up here?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to take an art class." And he said, "You come on in my office." And he sat me down and he said, "If you're going to go to college, go to college." So by the time I left there that day, I was taking a full course, and I went to college for 7 years and finally graduated from Morehead State. But in the meantime, I went to NDSU for several years, just taking courses here and there, and whenever I felt like it.
You're a tri-college student almost.
Yeah, I was a tri-college student, that's for sure. And also, I've had several courses at Concordia.
You got deeper into your commitment to publications when you became an owner of at the Midweek Eagle, I believe.
Well, before that, I was going to tell you about I also got to be a columnist purely by accident. After we moved to Fargo, I ran into Doris Eastman on the street one day, and she said that Francis Schaaf was going to stop writing for the Forum. He was a professor at NDSU who had covered what few cultural events there were here in those days on a freelance basis. Then she told me to apply for the job. I said, "Oh, I couldn't do that," but she encouraged me, so I applied and I got the job, and that was in 1965. Then I got the Forum to let me write a Sunday column every week, and that was the first regular coverage of the arts in Fargo. In 1971, I bought an interest in the Midweek when it started, and I have written the Red River Arts column for them ever since. That makes a column every week for over 22 years. My column has grown in length and space in the Midweek every year. I rely mostly on information that's mailed in to me, and I used to fill a lot of space with interviews and special features which take a lot of time. But I don't have time or space for those much anymore, a few over Christmas and New Year's, and in June and August when there's not much cultural activity here. People tell me all the time that they clip my column, well, the art column, calendar, and keep it from week to week. They especially keep travel columns, and I often get calls asking for information on hotels in New York or something in Europe that I wrote about 2 or 3 years before. The past few years, my column has covered my travels as much as local culture. I'm not a joiner, so I don't belong to many clubs. The Fargo Fine Arts Club, art section, and Roundtable, a literary club, are the only two. However, in 1965, I helped organize and was on the first board of directors for the Red River Arts Center. Tom Gunkelman was the president, and for the first 2 years, we met in the sewing room of his design studio and held outdoor art shows on the mall between the library and the city auditorium. Then we got the old Moorhead Post Office and hired a director. We went through several directors and a lot of problems before Jim Rourke finally became the director and the center became the Plains Art Museum.
I was sitting here thinking how you talk about organizing, and that is not easy. So it must have been pretty tough. And you get a lot of people with a lot of different ideas, and to try to come down to decision making.
Yeah, to try to decide how that thing ought to work, it was a lot of headaches, but it was interesting. Jim Rourke and his brother Orland had the first art gallery in Fargo Moorhead. It was in the old police station on Main Avenue. I don't think many people remember that now. One interesting thing that happened at the old Red River Art Center, they had art classes. And one of the classes we had was the first life class that I think was ever held in Fargo. I'm trying to think who ran it, but I can't. But Bob Walton was the teacher. And we were having it in the middle of the winter, and it was cold, and we had a nude model, and we're all painting her, but we had little heaters around to keep the place warm, but we were down in the basement. And one of them caught on fire, so we had to call the fire department, and the firemen came clumping down the stairs, and all of these nude paintings were all over the studio. The model had put her robe on, but they were just bug-eyed.
That was real shock culture for the firemen in Fargo.
For the firemen in Fargo, yeah. Well, Orland Rourke, who was in the gallery with Jim, began to teach at Concordia, and then Jim opened the present Rourke Gallery, which is in the house on 4th Street. At one time, he also had a gallery in the balcony of a dress shop in Fargo. And Jim Verdorn, who was a well-known artist here in those days, had a gallery in the basement on 8th Street. And I took a number of classes from him. 12 years ago, 15 local artists organized Gallery 4 in Block 6 in Fargo. We were there several years, and then we moved to Elm Tree Square a few years ago. There are now 36 artists in the gallery. They're all from this area, and they all own and run the gallery as a partnership. I was an original member, but I dropped out this year because we are planning to move. It's been in business 12 years, and that's very unusual for a for-profit art gallery. Most of them don't intend to make a profit and survive on grants. I also was a member of the NDSU Art Selection Committee for the Student Art Collection, one of the most interesting projects I've ever been involved in. One year in 1969, the NDSU Student Council got $10,000 to start a student art collection. I was a community member on the purchase committee with John Carlson, who was on the Fargo Park Board now. He was the alumni member, and Dr. Catherine Cater represented the faculty, and George Smith, at that time director of the student union, was our chairman. There were also several student members. And we got a man named James Demetrian, who was the head of the Des Moines Arts Center, to help us buy contemporary art in New York. He had a lot of money, or the Des Moines Arts Center had a lot of money, and he went to New York two or three times a year. And we got a matching grant from the National Arts and Humanities Council with more money from the students. And we really put together a remarkable collection of art with works by such famous artists as Judy Chicago, Ronald Davis, Max Ernst, Oscar Howe, Jasper Johns, Philip Perlstein, James Rosenquist, Frank Stella, and Andy Warhol.
You were responsible for $30,000 during that time that you originating.
We had that much money to buy that much art with, and along with a lot of other pieces, but those are the most important artists in the collection.
That was a responsibility. Did you all agree at one time on what you were going to purchase?
Oh, we almost always came to a consensus. Well, we always did come to a consensus, but sometimes we argued a little. We especially tried to get works with a local connection. One of these is Rosenquist, who was born in North Dakota, and Oscar Howe is a famous Indian artist from South Dakota. And there are a lot of works from local and area artists. Oh, there are like John Anderson. John Anderson lived in, I think it was Pelican Rapids. And he was really an artist with a national reputation, but unfortunately he was an alcoholic and died quite young. Leonardo Lisansky we have in the collection, and he was the head of the print department at the University of Iowa. And Gordon Mortensen, he was born in North Dakota and is a very famous printmaker these days.
As you bought that art, were you thinking ahead of the value of them or the interest of them?
Mostly the interest to North Dakota. Well, we had to take value into consideration. More than value, we had to take price into consideration because $30,000 doesn't go very far in the art market. And Della Pithio is in that collection. He has a show at the Plains Art Museum right now. And Walter Peel, he's in the art department at Minot, and he does wonderful kind of abstract cowboy things. And Cyrus Running, who was the head of the art department at Concordia for many years, and Jack Youngquist, who taught at Morehead State for many years. One of the artists we especially wanted represented in the collection was Clifford Still, who was born in Grandin, North Dakota, and is a very famous abstract artist with an international reputation. All the best galleries in the United States have works by Clifford Still. But even at that time, his works began at about $35,000, so trying to get one of his works led to a fascinating story in Fargo's art history. David Warden was the vice president at NDSU then, and he offered to try to contact Still. We couldn't find any way to get a hold of him even, but he offered to contact him on a trip out east. Still lived on an isolated farm someplace in New England. And Dave found him someplace, and eventually NDSU offered Still an honorary degree. And he and his wife came, and the art selection committee had a dinner for them. Afterwards, he told Dave Warden that he would give NDSU a whole collection of his work if NDSU would build a gallery for the works. And each of them is huge. They're just great big wall-sized pieces.
Wasn't this kind of a shocking offer?
Oh.
Did you know what to do?
We couldn't even believe it. It was just unbelievable. Well, anyway, I have to tell you what happened, which is a real tragedy. NDSU at that time was building the addition to the Student Union, which was to include a gallery for the student art collection. Instead, the plans were altered to build it to house the Still collection, which would have been a prize beyond the comprehension of most people in North Dakota. That's why, if you go to the NDSU Art Gallery, you see walls that are much higher than are needed. The reason you don't see the Still Art Collection there is because of one stupid NDSU student who was the editor of a student publication. He wrote a very critical article about the administration taking the gallery space away from the student collection for works by, quote, an artist no one had ever heard of, unquote, and then sent a copy of it to Still.
Oh, my goodness.
And he immediately withdrew his offer, and the Clifford Still collection is now in the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco.
Does anybody know where that student is?
Oh, I don't even remember his name, but I hope he's suffering.
Oh, my, that was a shock.
I'm especially fond of two works in the art collection because I'm responsible for their being there. One is the Judy Chicago, and she's one of the most important women artists in America today. I saw one of her works at a show at UND in Grand Forks and came back to insist that we buy it while it was here in the state. The other is the Ron Davis. I saw a beautiful work of his at the Chicago Art Institute. And when Mr. Dimitrion suggested him as an important rising young artist, I pushed for buying his work. And we got one, and it's permanently fixed to the north wall of the Student Union Lounge. The rest of the collection is in the lounge in another lounge on the second floor and scattered around in offices. It's a remarkable collection for a small Midwest university to own. Unfortunately, most people don't even know it's there, and NDSU students and teachers don't realize its importance. A couple of weeks ago, I went over to NDSU to see a film on Judy Chicago's Dinner Party. That's the most famous work she's done, and it's a huge work. I can't go into it, it takes too long. So the film takes an hour to run. But it took 5 years to make, with a whole lot of people helping her. And they put together a wonderful film about it. So I went to see the film. And while I was there, I kept thinking, I wonder if any of these people know we've got a Judy Chicago at NDSU. So I asked, and an English teacher from the English department was running the film. She didn't know it. And most of the other people there were students, and they had no idea that we'd had a Judy Chicago. So it's too bad that it's not more publicized.
So keeping the word out of what they have,
yeah,
is a hard part.
Yeah, people in Fargo have no idea that that wonderful collection is there, in spite of the fact that several articles have been written about it. And they published a nice catalog for it. I said there was a Cyrus Running work in that collection, and I should emphasize his important place in the history of art in North Dakota and western Minnesota. He was chairman of the Concordia Art Department for years and years, and by far the most important person in the area in the field of art until his death a few years ago. No other person freely gave so much of his time and talents and energy, not only to his paintings and mosaics, which are all over the area in churches and schools and private collections, but to promoting art. At our first Valley City Art Festival, he was a juror and the speaker at our festival banquet, and he gave us a lot of advice. He was also a very funny man who played the piano well, and he had a humorous piano act he performed whenever he was asked. I heard it several times. It was hilarious. The new Concordia Art Gallery is named for him. I started my own art collection with two Cyrus Running paintings. One year, I came into Fargo with friends from Valley City to go to a tea and art show at the Episcopal Cathedral, and I fell in love with two of his watercolor landscapes, but I couldn't find anyone to sell them. So when I got home, I called him up and arranged to meet him at his studio, which at that time was on the second floor of some downtown building. Later, they built a studio on his house. He had a lot of works in his studio, but I bought the two that I had liked, and they hung over my Davenport, both in our house in Valley City and the first house we owned in Fargo. For many years, I sold them, unfortunately, when we had a big auction, and I just couldn't bring everything with me when we moved over here. But I still have one of his nice drawings. And I have a Tom Kenline metal sculpture. He was the architect for the community theater. I have a Philip Thompson. He's from North Dakota, or Moorhead, I guess he is from Moorhead.
Did you try to buy a piece of art from the different people that you touched?
Not really.
Somehow?
If I liked the piece and I liked the person, I bought the work, if I could afford it. Philip Thompson is head of the art department at Oxford College and has a marvelous show at the Rourke Gallery right now. I'd like to have another one of them. The one I have is called Lennon Grid, and it's a very abstract piece about John Lennon, and I just love it. I have a B. Cummings, a K. Ornberg, a Dorothy Hall, a Dave Norstedt, a Kitten O'Day, and Yvonne Butson, and all of them are good friends of mine. A print and a plate by Andrew Wyeth, a painting by Szabo, and he's a very famous, nationally known watercolor artist that I took several classes from. And the piece I have is in one of his books, so that's kind of interesting. And I have a large landscape by Robert Wood, who is another very famous, nationally known watercolor artist. And I took several classes from him, and the piece I have was done as a demonstration in class, so I really treasure that. That was in Grand Rapids. And I have two pieces by James Conaway. He's one of my favorite artists right now. I only own posters of his because his works are terribly expensive, way in the thousands of dollars.
Have you ever taken a piece of your art collection and sold it for, for a profit? Or have you mostly kept your collection because you love it?
No, when we had a big auction when we moved from our house on 10th Street over here, and I sold a lot of pieces of art that just didn't happen to fit in this house. At that time, we didn't have the sunroom, so there wasn't that much wall space, so I had to get rid of some of them. But I really don't even know what they sold for. You know, auctions are so hectic. I didn't pay that much attention.
I know I gave away a piece of art once to somebody. It meant a lot to her, but now I think, gosh, why did I do that?
Yeah. Well, most of the pieces I bought, a lot of them I bought out of shows, and I've seen them at a show and gone home and thought about them and went back and bought the piece because I just thought I wanted it.
What other people have made an impact in this area in your time? Have you, you've been involved in the artwork of Charlie Beck?
Yeah, I took a lot of classes in Charles Beck, and at one time I had several of his paintings, but I don't have them anymore. I guess they got sold in my auction. And Charlie Beck has made a big impact on art in this area, too. I think next to Cyrus Running, probably he comes second in my mind. For years, several of my friends and I took a class once a week at night from him at the junior college. He's the head of the, or was, I think he's retired this year, head of the art department at the junior college at Fergus Falls.
The paintings I've seen that he has done are often in dark colors. They're not a bright spot in the room. Have I just seen a couple?
I think you've seen the wrong things, maybe.
We've got one of a tree, a black tree with no leaves on it, and I find it so hard to enjoy that room because
really? His
painting doesn't make me happy.
He just had a wonderful show at the Rourke Gallery just before this one by Philip Thompson. Oh, I wanted a dozen pieces out of it. They were so
gorgeous. Maybe this was a winter
scene. Well, he does all kinds of different things, and I think his prints are maybe darker than his paintings.
Did you have an involvement in the West Acres? Now, West Acres was formed about the time I moved to this area, I believe about 1971 or 72.
They started an art show. I can't remember the year exactly, but I was a director of their art show for the first 5 years that they had it, with, and that was when Barney O'Lavin was managing the West Acres, and Kelly Hillebold Adelson was his assistant. So we really started those shows. I own several works by Gordon Mortensen. I don't know if I mentioned him before or not, but he's a well-known printmaker. And then I've got several pieces that I bought in Europe and numerous other works that caught my fancy at art exhibits. To go back to Charlie Beck, I guess I told you that we went over there to his art classes for several years, and I think there were five of us that did that. And he was a great, I think he made a great impact on all of our paintings. People used to say that they could always recognize a Beck student.
Is there anybody else that you can think of that made an impact in your time in this area on the art?
Oh, one person I should mention is Laurel Ruder. She's the director of the art gallery at the University in Grand Forks and of the new North Dakota Art Museum that they are starting up there. I think she's by far the most important person in the arts in North Dakota today. She organizes wonderful shows, and some of them are of regional and national significance. This winter, she organized a national fiber show, which will tour all over Asia, and has written a book on fiber arts. A few years ago, she bought a great big truck and fitted it with a wonderful American Indian art exhibit, and it traveled all over North Dakota, at least. I don't know if they got into Minnesota with it or not. But in the first place, she's a wonderful fundraiser. And if she wants to do something, she knows where to get the money to do it. Another interesting job I had was as a director, as one of the directors of Trollwood Park in Fargo, or one of the people on the board of directors of the park, I should say.
Now, we should say that Trollwood Park is a culture park on the river in Fargo, part of the Fargo Park system.
Yes, it is. And Sally Stengel and Reed Jones, they organized the summer programs at the park for years on a volunteer basis with some paid teachers from the Fargo schools, especially John Marks, who directed the outdoor plays there, which have become such an important summer activity for both students and the public. The weekend programs at the park draw thousands of people to Trollwood for music and dance and drama and art, and Trollwood has become the third largest summer attraction in North Dakota after the Peace Gardens and Medora. All three of those remarkable people are gone now. John Marks lives in Hawaii, Marie Jones is in Seattle, and Sally has retired to the woods north of Grand Marais. I also had the first TV program on the arts in KFME, that's public television. Carl Brookings was manager of the station at that time, and he asked me to do a program called The Gallery. For 2 years, I interviewed people of interest in the arts every week. Another fascinating job I had was as a member of the North Dakota Arts Council. Governor Art Link appointed me as a member in 1973 and again in 1977. I had to get off the council in 1974 when I was elected to the North Dakota House of Representatives. And Governor Link thought I would have a conflict of interest. Previous to getting on the council, I had written a monthly column for them, which went to all the schools and colleges and arts organizations in the state. I was kicked off the council in 1978 when Governor Alan Olson fired all of the Democrats on the council, including Dr. John Hovey, who had directed the council from the beginning. John died not long after that. I was also on the first board of directors of the Red River Dance and Performing Company, run by Eddie and Kathy Gasper. It has grown to be a valuable asset to the community, and as has the Makata Dance Company, which is directed by Kathy Foss Baucom. The community theater actors were performing in an old church near downtown when I first attended one of their performances. So I watched the building of the Emma Herbst Theater in Island Park and the growth of the performances there. George Nassif is being honored there this year for all of his service to the community theater. The Herbst family is another chapter in the cultural life of Fargo. They contributed money for the Emma Herbst Theater and gave generously of time and money for many other projects. Sherry Herbst in particular was a mover and shaker when I first moved to Fargo. The Outdoor Art Festival, which was held in Island Park for many years, was one of her projects. I think the Junior League was involved in that too, as was the Red River Annual. It was a sad day when the Herbst stall left Fargo and the department store closed. Sherry and I were two of the first recipients of the YWCA Women of the Year Awards in 1973. I got the award in art, and she got an award for her volunteer efforts. We got wooden plaques that year instead of the silver plates they've given ever since.
That was because at that time they
didn't have any money.
No.
Another person I should mention is Dr. Frederick Walsh. He was running the theater at NDSU long before we moved here. I attended a lot of plays in the original Little Country Theater on the second floor of Old Main and met Mr. Askenes in the lovely new NDSU Theater for which he donated the money. He bought one of my paintings of Old Front Street for his office in Texas. He had lived on Front Street as a child. I guess that's part of Main Avenue now. Another person is Dr. Delmer Hansen. He was at MSU directing the theater when we moved here. And I remember the first Straw Hat Theater performance I saw was in the new junior college at Fergus Falls because MS didn't have a suitable theater. And the play was Once Upon a Mattress, I remember it distinctly. Now they have a beautiful new Center for the Arts Theater, and the Straw Hat Theater program is famous.
Do you have any idea what year that was that Morehead State got that nice theater? I remember coming up from...
It was shortly after we moved here, though. I attended a lot of plays in the little old theater at Concordia also. That was over a wooden building over in the middle of the campus. Don't know what they called it. Now they have their new excellent Francis Frazier Comstock Theater, named for its donor, and the new Olin Art and Communication Center it is. That's a beautiful building. And MSU has a wonderful art department in the Center for the Arts and an art gallery. Dr. Claire Haugen was the chairman of the Concordia Theater Department, and he and I did an interesting interview one time. He was doing an Ibsen play, I think it was Hedda Gabler, using a translation by Rolf Feldy. Rolf Feldy is a famous Ibsen scholar in New York, and he has roots in North Dakota and belongs to a famous artistic family. I had written about him several times before, but that time we had a three-way conference on the telephone, and I interviewed him for my column, and Claire talked about the play with him. It was really fun. And later I met Ralph Feldy when he came to Valley City to accept an honorary degree from Valley City State College for his father, Paul, who is an internationally famous sculptor, was, I should say, an internationally famous sculptor. He's dead now. I have never had any personal contact with the Fargo Theater, but I consider it and the organists who run it one of the greatest cultural assets in Fargo. We had part of our 50th wedding anniversary celebration there, and out-of-town guests were absolutely fascinated. They showed an old Harold Lloyd movie and a Betty Boop cartoon for us, and made up a film just for us of old friends and neighbors, and dished out free popcorn. It was a lot of fun.
Now, you also had part of that at Archie's West. Now,
yeah,
Archie's
we did.
West,
oh, I should mention Archie's Gallery. That's a wonderful asset to the area. Archie Miller has collected them. Absolutely fantastic collection of art of all kinds. He's very Catholic in his tastes. He likes everything. And so they have a permanent collection all over this huge gallery, a beautiful room. And his daughter, Beverly, runs it. Just a wonderful gallery. And
it was put behind a hardware building. You know, that was the strange part about it.
Yes, he runs this, I don't know what that store is that he has. They sell everything under the sun.
You get anything you want there.
Anything you want, they've got it.
But they do seem to be successful.
No, very successful. That's only one of many stores they have. But it's the only art gallery they have. And it's just really a delightful gallery. And it was a wonderful place to have a reception. Just, they don't have much of a kitchen, but I had a caterer and she managed it. The space was wonderful. Everybody just loved it out there, too. That was fun, too, because Gallery 4 had an art show there. Well, we had our anniversary, so they did that on purpose for our anniversary.
Oh, that one must have been fun.
Mm-hmm. Both Morehead State and Concordia now have wonderful new art departments and galleries, which I've watched grow from makeshift buildings like the Berg Art Center at Concordia and a third-floor facility at Morehead State. All three have growing and excellent music departments and drama departments with fresh, new, lovely theaters. The MFM Symphony was a going concern under the direction of Sigvald Thompson and his wife Isabel Thompson when we first came here. And it's still going strong under Bob Hansen, yeah.
And now his son is certainly making the news.
Oh, isn't he though? Yeah. Didn't I see he's directing orchestra in Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta Symphony.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's a remarkable young man. I did an interesting feature about him a couple of years ago when he won a conducting contest in Europe.
Yes.
That was fun. Very nice young man.
That's a very nice family.
Oh,
Lois and Robert Hansen.
Yes, and Lois is a...
They've contributed to this area.
Yeah, she runs a public radio station.
Now, your interests have even gone into opera, and I guess I've always wished that I could obtain that interest. How did you...
I really don't have a great interest in opera, but it's been interesting to watch the opera grow here. I have no musical background. The only thing I know about music is what I like. People always say, I don't know a thing about art, but I know what I like. And that's how I am about music, really. But I often go just to try to educate myself. But they've had a wonderful success under the direction of David Martin. Also, the Concordia Christmas concerts are a big drawing card in Morehead. They draw thousands of people every year to their Christmas concert.
Do you attend most of those?
I've never missed one. Since we moved to Valley City, I've never missed a Concordia Christmas.
No.
I think they're the most thrilling thing in the world. I just
now,
love
what
them.
Is your impression from last year's Paul J. Christensen to Renee Claussen? Not to be negative, but did you find a difference?
They're
did you
different.
Find them uplifting?
They're different. the first year that Clausen had the Christmas concert, I was disappointed in it, just because it was different. Last year, I thought it was fabulous. I thought it was just fabulous. So he's doing a wonderful job, too. It's different, but it's just as good.
And, of course, David Hetland, whose mentor was Cyrus Running.
Cy Running. They both have done that mural for years and years. And Hetland does it just as well as Running, really.
And
they're beautiful.
The Daggett Trucking outfit out of Frazee, Minnesota, tugs and lugs and puts those murals on a truck and donates her time and takes it to Minneapolis for the concert there. Now, do you ever go down to the city?
I've never gone to it there, no.
That must be especially.
Yeah, it would be wonderful to see it there in that lovely building.
Now, you have been involved in Concordia, it seems to me, quite a bit, and you mentioned the language camps. Have you ever attended
No, I never attended the language camps. I wish I could have sent my grandson, but I never did. I did go one year when they had, I think they had built a new building, and they invited a lot of people to an introduction to this new building, and we went to that, and so we got to tour the camps and see what it looked like, and it's a wonderful place.
But you did take two trips on the seminars abroad, the May seminars abroad.
Yeah, and that's another one, a wonderful program that they had. At those language camps, children go to learn various languages in a summer camp situation, and it's just a wonderful thing for them. I just envy every kid that could do that.
Concordia is just releasing information on their new Japanese camp.
Yeah, I noticed they're going to do that. Mm-hmm. They've had German and Norwegian and French. And
I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
I can't remember.
I don't know. M-A-K-I something.
Yeah, I don't know how you pronounce it.
Now, you continue to amaze me. You had a travel agency for a time. Was it for 12 seasons? Or did you have 12 tours?
I don't even remember how long I had it, but I started it with two friends. We called it Variety Tours. And mostly we just took people on bus trips to Minneapolis and Winnipeg to cultural events and everything else of interest there. They were a lot of fun, and we enjoyed it. Eventually we split up, and I had my own company called KCAN Incorporated. And I took two other kinds of tours. Once I took a group to New Orleans over the Christmas holidays, and that was fun. And one year I took another group of people to England and Scotland and Ireland, and that was an interesting trip.
I've been
on trips to Europe 7 times, and two of them were Concordia seminars abroad, and those tours are just wonderful.
Now, how do you compare going on a tour to putting on the tour? Wasn't there a good deal of stress involved?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of stress involved in conducting the tour. A lot of stress, especially to Europe. Yeah.
Now the money exchange is causing a furor there.
Well, the money was good in the days that I took tours, but it would be tough today, especially.
I'm sure you know Verlin Anderson takes tours to Norway just about every year. Well, this year he's not. He's going to the East Coast.
Oh, is that a fact?
They're going to do a historical trip.
I didn't know that. Well, two tours I took with Concordia were both theater tours with Claire Haugen. And one year we went to 32 plays in 30 days in London. And actually, Mabel Scheel was with me on that tour. She was one of the Scheel hardware. She's dead now, unfortunately. But we had a wonderful time together. And that year she and I also went to Ireland. We took a special tour, just the two of us, to Ireland for 4 days, and we saw play at the Abbey Theatre while we were there, too. So the next time I went with him, we saw 28 plays, but we saw them all over England. We went to many, they have a network of really good regional theatres all over England, and we saw many of those, like we saw the Canterbury Tales at Canterbury and things like that. It was a wonderful tour.
Have you ever wished, or have you put together a journal that was filled with, I would have a hard time remembering 32 different plays I went to and reading. I'm sure you read. Do you ever journal and keep track of all those
wonderful things you've seen? Well, I wrote about them while I was over there, so I have all of those columns. Someday I should put them in a scrapbook, but I never have.
You don't have them in a scrapbook?
No, I should do that. The last trip I took, I think, was to Greece. It was a wonderful trip, too. These days I confine my travel to the United States and Canada. My legs are not very good anymore. And Stan and I are hoping to take a trip to Prince Edward Island, where his family came from. We've always intended to do that.
Now, somewhere along the line, and I think your son helped you get into politics.
Yeah, that's true. I had no interest in politics, none at all. And it's odd, too, because I should have developed an interest in Valley City. We lived in a network of politicians. Behind us, the Fosses lived behind us, and Al Foss's father was the head of the Appropriations Committee for the North Dakota Legislature for years and years and years. I knew him very well. And our backdoor neighbor was related to one of the ex-governors, and Gordon Gray and Gorman King were both running the Democratic Party in those days, and they were backdoor neighbors. And Betty Paulson was in my birthday club, and her husband Bill became a member of the North Dakota Supreme Court. But anyway, I had no interest in their political problems at all in those days. But when my son, Jack, well, after the Democratic Convention in Chicago, I decided that we'd had quite strained relations with our son Jack, who had dropped out of college to go down south and work for civil rights. He graduated from Carleton and got a full fellowship to Stanford in the medical school in California, and he stayed there 3 years and then just left and went down to Alabama. But after that convention, I decided he was right, and things had to change in this country, so I got involved in the McCarthy campaign for president. Alice Olson was the director of the campaign that year, and she was just getting her feet wet in politics. She was a force in Democratic politics here for several years and helped me get elected as a delegate to the Democratic Convention in Miami in 1972, where I was a Shirley Chisholm delegate, but I voted for McGovern. Alice was honored at Morehead State last year as a distinguished alumni. Unfortunately, she doesn't live here anymore. The most interesting thing about that convention was George Wallace. I guess it was interesting to me because of my son Jack, who by that time had worked his way up to Minneapolis, where he was running a tenants union and making a lot of problems for the city commission and the housing people in Minneapolis. And he had gone to a George Wallace speech at the city auditorium and got arrested for disturbing the peace with a friend of his. So when I went to the convention, George Wallace had been shot, and he couldn't make the rounds of, you know, shaking hands with all the delegations like most of them were doing. So he invited, or he had people come and invite every delegation to meet with him in his hotel. So when he came to North Dakota, they asked if we wouldn't like to do that, and nobody wanted to except me. I said, oh, I'd love to go. I wanted to meet that character. He's certainly a historical part of our national life. So finally, after I said I wanted to go, why, a lot of people wanted to go, and they came with two limousines and took us way across Miami to this great big hotel. We went in the lobby and it was full of men with guns. We got in the elevator and it was had a man with a gun running the elevator. Got off on the top floor and there were men lining the hall with guns. So we went in and...
Were you real glad you were there?
Oh, we were petrified. So we got in there in this big room and started to sit down, and a man with a gun came and said, are you all delegates? Well, we had a lot of people with us that weren't delegates. They were wives and the little interns and several teenage kids that were there as interns who had wanted to meet George Wallace. And they wouldn't let them stay. They made them go back down in the lobby with all those men with the guns. So the rest of us sat around and waited, and pretty soon his wife came in. I can't think of her name now. A lovely, charming southern lady. Just as nice as she could be. And eventually he came, and he went in his wheelchair around the circle and talked to each of us personally. So when he got to me, I said, you know, Governor, we had a lot of other people with us, and they wouldn't let them come in to meet you. And he said, you, go and get her friends. So somebody went down and brought up everybody else, so they all got to meet George Wallace. Mm-hmm. So I brought home a George Wallace button to my son Jack, who didn't really appreciate it. Jack Jack is now an attorney for the city of Minneapolis. He finally got a law degree by going to William Mitchell College of Law, to night school, and he's a housing consultant. Our youngest son, Jim, has a master's degree from NDSU and a doctor's degree from Purdue, and he's a professor of political science at Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas. We have two grandchildren. Jim's son, Brian, who lives with him in Topeka, will be 22 in May, and Michael Connor Can, son of Jack, and his wife, Ellen, will be a year old in May. Ellen is also an attorney.
Well, those sons of yours have gone on to complete their education. Did they encourage your education, or did you encourage them?
I encouraged them, I guess, as much as I can. Well, they were glad I went back to college. Yeah. It certainly was a wonderful experience, and in fact, I'd be going today if I had the time and the energy. I just love taking college classes. Well, freelance writers don't make much money. You have to balance that against your personal freedom, the freedom to do as you please. The midweek never edits me, and that's the best thing about them. Sometimes I'm cut because of lack of space, but otherwise they never touch my columns. And I can write anything I want, and they don't really care.
I want to tell you a personal experience from your column. You really take a lot of thought, because our Lake Association, Big Cormorant, had the very first tour of homes.
I wrote about it.
Yes, and not only did you just take the information off the paper, but you suggested a place for them to start the tour, and we made $2,500 in 4 hours.
Is that a fact?
At that tour of homes for our Lake Association. It was a beautiful, sunshiny day.
It was a lovely
so
day.
So that helped. Mm-hmm. But people just came in it, and Carlos, we had such a jam where our coffee break was, and I know a lot of that is to do with your column and your interest in adding to it and not just simply lifting it off the paper.
I had an interesting experience. When I first started to write the column for the forum, somebody introduced me to a lady in town, and she said, "Oh, you're that Kay Can. I hate you." And I said, "What did I ever do to you?" And she said, "Well, you write that column." She said, "I used to be blissfully unaware of what was going on around here, and now I read that column and I drool and I can't go because I've got three kids at home and I have to stay home and take care of them." But it's been an interesting experience.
I'd like to, when you're ready to talk about the kinds of art that you have actually painted and the media you use in painting. We haven't talked about that at all.
Well, I'm an oil painter and I do mostly landscapes. I'm an escape painter. In fact, when I started to paint in Stillwater, I really started because, well, I started at Joe Rollins' summer art school. But when I started with Carrick, it was several years later, and after I had two small children, it was after the war. Stan came home from the war, a disabled veteran, and was in and out of the hospital. And, I felt quite put upon. My mother was living with us, and she was sick. And so I just turned them all off and went one day to art class and forgot all about it, so I escaped.
And you still use the oil painting.
And I still escape, really. I don't paint unless I'm in a good mood and I feel right and there's something I'm dying to paint. I don't, paint every day like some people do. I paint when I feel like it.
Well, when you had art shows, you must have had to...
One of the problems with being in the gallery was we were supposed to have two new paintings every month. I hardly ever did, because I don't paint that much anymore. I used to paint that much, but I don't anymore. If you're going to have an art show, of course you've got to paint for that. So I hardly ever have them anymore because I don't want to be pushed like that. But I paint when I feel like it. But I love to paint landscapes. That's about the only thing I do. So.
And you don't? You've never gone, or have you tried the acrylic that dries faster?
Oh yeah.
But you still go back to
it. Yeah, I use acrylics. I don't like them as well. And I've taken many, many watercolor classes. And I wish I could do watercolors, but I don't have the patience to do that.
The washes in the watercolor classes are what drew me crazy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is a man who's dedicated to 1 year of watercolor, and it was washes, washes, washes. I love
watercolor. I really like them better than oil paintings, but they're not for me to do. I buy them, but I don't paint them.
Do you find that... Well, more and more things come out all the time for art, in art supplies.
Yeah, there's another Another medium I like is alkyd. It's kind of in between both oil and...
An acrylic.
It doesn't dry quite as fast, and it looks more like oil. But it dries faster than oils, and it's a really good...
I've also heard of experimenting and using the magic markers within your acrylics.
You can.
And getting more detail with them.
I'm not much for experimenting like that. I'm more of a writer than I am of an artist, frankly. So I like to paint just for relaxation. But if it's going to be a strain, I don't like to. I've taught a lot of art classes. I've taught at the vocational school for many years. And I've always told my students, if it isn't fun, don't do it. Which maybe is the wrong thing to do, but that's how I feel about it.
Now,
and for me, it's fun.
What kind of teaching, then? Were you into the different media, or were you in drawing?
No, I just taught oil painting.
Just in oil painting?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's going to stay with us, oil painting? You think that's just a...
It's still the best medium there is. Yeah, it really is. I was going to tell you about freelance writing. Freelance writers don't make much money, but you have to balance that against your personal freedom. The thing is that you can do as you please. I've always tried to pay myself at least $10 an hour, which is not very much. But I've not had a raise for years, in spite of the fact that my column gets longer and longer. But I just don't spend any more time on it than I have to. And as I say, I don't do very many features anymore.
How many people see that Midweek Eagle column? What's the circulation
like? Oh, it's like about 50,000. It's all over this area,
for
miles.
When you got into the Midweek Eagle, had it started, or were you in the starting phase?
It just barely started. Uh-huh. I think I saw the first issue and went out and talked to them.
And did you have any doubt, or did you have great... belief that it was going to make it as a shopper? We have a new shopper starting out in Detroit Lakes that's doing very nicely.
There's a few of them starting every so often. It's amazing how many papers have started here recently, but they don't make it so expensive these days to start a paper. But when the Midweek started, it was just at the right time. It was affordable, and they could do it, and they did it. They made a wonderful
Luvinow.
Sense. And they got Luvinow. Mm-hmm. I think that's made them successful.
Adelson.
And
you have
Jim
Barney
Adelson.
Lavin still in there.
Yeah, he's still there too. Mm-hmm.
So you've made it more of a featureized shopper.
Yeah, it's a little different than most shoppers, I think.
And they usually work with a front cover.
Yeah, and that's a big help. Those
special.
Covers are taken for a year in advance.
Really?
Yeah. Well, there's another thing about freelancing is you have no perks like hospitalization and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of disadvantages to it, but there's advantages too.
You don't have that 8 to 5 o'clock syndrome.
You don't have 8 to 5. When I first bought an interest in the Midweek, I did work out there 8 to 5, and I hated it. So this has worked out well for me. I've loved every minute of it. Another friend I had was Ann Brown Bowen. She was the art department at the old North Dakota Agricultural College, which is now NDSU, and a well-known sculptor. The Walker Art Center has one of her pieces, and people all over town treasure her sculptures. I organized a retrospective of her sculpture at NDSU one year, and that was shortly before she died. She was a lovely person. And I want to finish with an interesting story she told me. In the 1930s, the American Association of University Women had a national program to survey art all over the United States, and they sent people to every state. And the woman who came to North Dakota came to Ann for information. And Ann sent her on a tour around the state, and when she came back to Fargo, she told Ann that the only art in the whole state of North Dakota is its elevators. She'd never say that today.
Well, thank you, Kay. This has been an interesting interview, and your life has certainly been full. And I asked you why in the world you were going to retire to International Falls, Minnesota, and apparently that has some loving ties back.
Well, I was born in International Falls, and Stan lived there shortly when he was a child, His family were lumbermen up in that area. And my father was the yard master for the railroad for 35 years up there. My mother taught school in the